Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Best Ever You Show with your hosts, Elizabeth Hamilton Garino, CEO and founder of the Best Ever You Network, and Dr. Katie Eastman. The Best Ever You Show is here to help you live your life to the fullest. How? Real people, including celebrities, real advice, real places, products, and businesses, real life stories with this radio show, printed magazine, websites, community, and more. And now, here are your hosts, Elizabeth and Katie.
Well, we have the Elizabeth part of the Elizabeth and Katie, but not quite the Katie. Oh, hang on. We've got the Katie. The Katie
I'm
part
here.
Of the show. There you are. That's funny. We're working our way through a tiny bit of audio reverb. I have no idea why, but, whatever. It is what it is.
Oh,
right,
now?
Katie?
Is
no,
it,
not yet.
Just,
it's just been, I don't know, just something going on our show today. I have no idea what it is, but it's just a little bit annoying. But hi.
Hi.
Hello. Hi. So, Katie, how are you today?
I'm good.
What are you working on today?
I am getting ready to go into work and work on a support group I'm starting. So
that's cool.
What
yeah.
I'm working on.
Well, it's been I'm a little tired today. We've had baseball. I've got the four boys and three of them play baseball and one of them swims. So we're in full baseball mode. But today it's raining. So maybe we won't have baseball tonight. I'm not positive. But what a busy week, and what a cool show we had on Tuesday with Nick Ortner of The Tapping Solution. That was pretty interesting information, wasn't it?
It was. It was so wonderful. I'm actually going to order the book and use it. I actually started talking about it with a patient, and she said, oh, you're talking about EFT. And she knew all about it. It's helped her with her oncology. It's really been, I think it's a great book. I'm going to definitely get it and start using it.
Yeah, well, I forwarded the show to everybody at Hay House, and they were all just tickled that he was on the show and just happy about the book being mentioned and everybody. So it was pretty cute. But anyway, so let's move on to our wonderful guest. We have, I need to not destroy her last name. I've promised to get this right. We have Barbara Jakubowski on with us. And
perfect.
Her last name, hi, Barbara. Her last name is spelled D-Z-I-K-O-W-S-K-I. If you want to look her up as an author, we're going to be here talking about her debut novel, Searching for Lincoln's Ghost. And then it sounds like she's got a couple other things in the works here, too, a second and a third novel, which I can't wait to talk to her about. But Katie, Barbara has an undergraduate degree in philosophy and a graduate degree in counseling from Indiana University. So you guys are like peas in a pod.
Yeah, I have religion and history in counseling. So, yes, definitely.
So,
well,
Barbara,
very
well,
much.
Welcome.
Well, welcome.
Go.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on your program. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, we're pretty conversational and informal, so bear with us as we goof around and so forth. But can you tell us just a little bit about how you go from philosophy and a graduate degree in counseling to writing a fiction book?
Well, I'll try. You know, when you get a degree in philosophy, there's not a lot you can do with that, But it was a great experience. If I had to do it again, I wouldn't do it any different way. I used both of those degrees in what I'm doing now, and when Katie said she just is talking about a support group, I actually just finished doing one this morning. In my other life, my day job, I work with, I'm a program director, and I work with mostly caregivers, but some individuals who are going through Alzheimer's and various forms of dementia. So we had our monthly group just about an hour ago, and it's one of the joys of my life and what I do. I get so much inspiration from family caregivers. They really are amazing in their ability to be resilient and cope with a disease like Alzheimer's that goes on for years and years and years. So it's a joy to work with them. How my trajectory has been kind of strange. I started out when I first got my degree. I worked with Marriott Corporation for many years in the hospitality industry, and I lived on both coasts with that job and in Chicago. But basically, my trajectory took me back to the Midwest, where I wanted to pursue a degree in counseling, which I had wanted to do for a long, long time. And so they had a program that fit my needs and could enable me to work full-time. And so it was kind of a strange course. But all through this, the one consistent thread is that I've been a writer. I've always written since I've been a young child.
Hmm. Katie, you must have. Yeah, I was going to say you guys have kind of similar careers.
Well, I'm busting. I'm one of the things I want to know. So you're a writer, and why this book? What? Tell us about this book. Why? How? Why this particular project?
Okay. Well, before I answer that, I just wanted to say I really enjoyed your interview. I think it was just earlier this month with Gabe Berman, who wrote Live Life Like a Fruit Fly.
We swore a little bit during that interview. Did you bleep us out?
Well, I really enjoyed it because I think the message that he gave is to trust yourself enough to believe in what you have to say is worth saying. And also, if you want to write, just write. And, I must say, I wrote two novels that ended up in the trash. I went through the whole process, but through my career, you evolve. And so, those weren't wasted times, even though those novels never, even passed my own scrutiny. Everything you do is a learning experience. So for this book, and I think it's all a part of your theme to your show about living life to the fullest. What Searching for Lincoln's Ghost does, this book, I wanted to write it because there's a lot of themes that I think we really need to take out and look at in our society. One of them is fear. Emerson wrote, always do what you are afraid to do. And I think this is a major theme of Searching for Lincoln's Ghost. It's a coming-of-age novel about growing up in the mid-1960s. And that was a time when the country was still largely segregated, but things were rapidly changing. But change, as we're seeing a lot of changes now in our society, change is the breeding ground for our deepest fears. And in order to really reach our potential, be our best, we need to conquer our fears. Our fears cripple us in so many ways. It's the catalyst for all forms of oppression and hatred and abuse and intolerance. So these themes are kind of interwoven in Searching for Lincoln's Ghost. It begins as a look back from an adult's perspective, but at its heart, it's a story about a young, lonely girl who's also dealing with great fear and change in her life. To begin with, she's lost both her parents in a car accident, and she's being raised by a grieving grandmother who is just kind of obsessed still with her own daughter's death. And so, Andy is basically growing up with a lot of fears and anxieties about death and dying and wondering what's happened to her parents. And her school, the Lincoln Elementary School, is purportedly haunted by the ghost of Abraham Lincoln. Over its 100-year history, two sixth graders claim to have seen his ghost in the high school auditorium. So basically, Andy's on a quest. She's on a mission. She wants to be the next sixth grader to see Lincoln's ghost and talk with Lincoln's ghost, mostly because she feels if she can do that, then her parents are somewhere, that death goes isn't the end. And that's kind of her mission.
It's a really good book. And what else I liked about it? It's not forever long.
No.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a nice read. Where can people buy your book, Searching for Lincoln's Ghost? Can they just go on Amazon and order
it? Yeah, they can go on Amazon. They can go on Barnes & Noble. There's a number of smaller booksellers that they can also order it from. And I know my name goes on and on and on. I mean, if you just want to Google Searching for Lincoln's Ghost, that's probably easier than remembering my name. It's available on a lot of different folks and places, and I think it can also be special ordered in a Barnes & Noble bookstore.
And to me, it seems like the book is written for probably anybody age maybe like 10 or up, like a good reader who's 10 could, like my son read it. And he's 11, and there's nothing offensive in it or anything like that. I didn't know if you geared it for a tween or a teen reader, though.
Sure. Well, you know, it's interesting, the, you know, when I'm trying to figure out what genre it is, I wanted it to be a young adult. I mean, there are some substantive themes in there, like clergy abuse is a topic. So, and, you know, race relations is a topic, certainly. You know, depression, fear. And so I think you can take it on a lot of different levels. It's also a good ghost story. I mean, the ghost stories about Abraham Lincoln are real-life ghost stories that are going around. Those weren't, you know, created by the book. There's a lot of folklore out there about Lincoln's ghost. And part of all of our childhoods are ghost stories. And, you know, so that's a good hook for young readers. But I think it's also can be taken on a lot of different levels. And you know, most of my readers, frankly, have been adult readers.
Yeah.
Who,
he kind of said, no, I don't think this is a, I don't think, I'm a real strong reader, but I don't know if anybody else in my class could probably read this.
Yeah,
So and that was fifth grade. So maybe it needs to go up.
Well, I would think, you know, like maybe a high school level.
Yeah.
I think, you know, in tone.
So.
Yeah, well, that's
yeah.
great. I mean, I think in tone and style, it's you know, certainly I'm not comparing it as, you know, to Kill a Mockingbird, but in tone and style, I think you can take that book on a lot of different levels. And I remember reading it in high school, probably in 10th grade. And I've reread it several times as an adult, and I saw it with all different eyes as an adult reader to when I first read it as a high school student. So I think, you know, it's true also with this book. It's kind of wherever you are. I know that a lot of boomers, because it is about growing up in the 1960s, a lot of the baby boomers have enjoyed it on the level of saying, boy, it really took me back to my own childhood and what it was like to grow up in the 60s.
I'm wondering why Abraham Lincoln? What does he represent in this film? I mean, it's really interesting to me that you've got the 60s and you've got Abraham
Lincoln. He's on a film kick. You said film.
Well, late Abraham Lincoln, his role is largely symbolic in the book. But, you know, studying life, the life of Lincoln is a part of every American's childhood. I at age 11, which is the age of the main character in the book, I took a trip to Springfield, Illinois, which is also a part of the book. And I really got into Lincoln at that age. And I think many children do, because he captures us on a lot of different levels, coming up from poverty, the freeing the slaves, all the good works he's done, his pictures hang on, you know, our hallways and our schools. And I think everybody is kind of captivated by Abraham Lincoln at some point in their childhood. So that was another kind of a hook to growing up that we all share. Also, Lincoln is kind of our collective moral compass, if you will. We you know, it doesn't matter if you're Democrat, it doesn't matter if you're Republican, we all kind of still, everybody loves Abraham Lincoln. Really, when I was kind of thinking about writing this book and doing a look back to sixth grade year, I came across all this wonderful folklore about Lincoln's ghost. It's even on the White House website, you know, about Lincoln's ghost. And some very famous people in history have claimed to see Lincoln's ghost. In fact, Winston Churchill, when he was a guest in the White House. It's actually quite humor. He was coming out of the bathtub and was stark naked, and he saw Lincoln's ghost. And, you know, that seems like a rather inopportune time to see a ghost. And there are some funny stories, and there's some great stories, and there's some poignant stories, and it kind of captured my imagination even now. And I thought, boy, you know, this is the kind of thing when you're a kid, you really hook into the ghost stories. And also, you know, there's a lot about depression in this book. And Joshua Shank wrote a book about Lincoln's depression a few years back. And he's kind of a, you know, the whole premise of that book is that Lincoln probably would not have become the great man he had become had he not suffered from depression, it really helped him to develop a capacity to understand people who are suffering, and his whole empathy with slavery. So, you know, it was a great hook to teach some life lessons as well.
And what was, aside from always just wanting to write, and I hear that that part of writing exists in me all the time too. I have oodles and oodles of things that never see the light of day. But was there any one thing that you can point to that inspired you to write about this topic, or inspires you to write?
Life inspires me to write. And, you know, I think I'm at a point in my life, you know, there's a lot of great books out there, and most authors start writing at a younger age, seriously, than I started. And I think there's so many great books from young authors, but I think there's also, when you're in later life and you've gone through some experiences, I think there's kind of a depth that older authors can bring to life experience. You know, there's got to be some benefit to getting older. And I think that's one of them that, you know.
You discover it. We'll do another call.
So just that, you know, you look at life differently as you age. And I think generally people want to find meaning in life. And people start to think about their own mortality more. And, you know, young people feel they're going to live forever and they're immortal. And I just think that as I, especially as I started actually, after I got my counseling degree and started to work with families and do counseling, I just, something about that experience triggered the writing impulse in me. So I really started seriously writing in the late 90s, and I haven't really stopped since. Before that, it was kind of hit or miss.
Now, before we...
You know, it's...
Oh, go ahead, Kate.
Oh, go ahead. No, well, I was going to say, it's really fun to ask questions about the thinking process when someone's writing a book. And I was born in 1960, so I'm really curious, why 60? Why the 60s?
Oh, man, the 60s. I was born in 55, so I was young in the 60s, but the 60s, I've always been about like 4 to 5 years ahead of my time from when I was a child, like probably because I was the youngest in the family and I generally hung around with older people. But the 60s just fascinate the heck out of me. I think the 60s were such a unique time in our history. It was the time where all the best and brightest dreams of youth, there was so many youth at that time, of course, with the boomers, but everything was being reinvented. It was really the protests of the Vietnam War. It was kind of like, is this the way we're going to solve our problems by war, or are we going to find another course? Are we going to have peace over war? Are we going to hate each other and be prejudiced, or are we going to conquer some of those? And all these big issues because of the exuberance and idealism of youth and, of course, women's rights and African-American rights. They were all kind of coming out into the open and being birthed into a changing reality. So it was a time of change, turmoil, wild idealism. And so that time fascinates me. And I was a huge devotee of Robert Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy. In fact, my second book, he's kind of a cameo character in that. He came to my city a lot when he was running for president, and I think the dreams were kind of crushed in the year of 68 when Martin Luther King was murdered, when Robert Kennedy was murdered, and all of a sudden everything went back to the way it was again. And I think that was such a time of we could have gone one direction, and it ended up being seeded back to the old ways. And I still look at that time and think with a lot of regret and thinking, you know, what would have happened if those two deaths hadn't occurred. So I the 60s are a time that really inspire me to write. And there's a lot of issues in this book. There's about bullying is a part of this book. Prejudice is a part of this book. You know, child abuse is a part of this book. And I wanted to tell the story of segregation as it was the last gasp in the mid-60s of being a segregated society and make the point that injustice is injustice. It doesn't matter the issue. It doesn't matter the era. That's the main point of, you know, when are we going to learn that there's never the next group to hate coming down the pike? When are we going to actually try to do things in a different way and understand each other? And, you know, we talk about changing the world, but if everybody just changes themselves, that's all we need to do. Everybody will get changed that way, and to look inside ourselves. And usually the things we're prejudiced about are things we're afraid of. And that's why, again, that fear of theme, that theme of conquering our fears is so important.
What do you think Abraham Lincoln would have done if he had been president sometime in the mid-1960s?
Oh, man. You know, it's hard to know because we're all a product of our times. You know, there's also a line of thought to say, well, Lincoln really so much, you know, it wasn't so much the slaves, it was the time. It was just the time that he felt that needed to happen, that was something that was morally wrong and that needed to be changed at his period in history. It's hard to say because we probably would, you know, the way we crucify our leaders now, you know, it's hard to think we'd give anybody a pass, even Lincoln, now, if he was back doing what he needed to do. I think, again, our fear of change is so strong. I would like to think that, you know, Lincoln in his wisdom and the way he had of working things through, you know, would find a way to unify, you know, the country, the world. We're at such a divide right now, again, in our country of our ideology and our beliefs. And, you know, it's not a civil war, but maybe in our ideologies, we're heading that way. We're separating out, and that concerns me a great deal. You know, I don't know if you saw the film Lincoln. He had to do a lot of the get it done, whatever you need to do, even if there were some dirty deals behind the scenes to get, you know, what he needed passed. So I don't know that, you know, we do idealize people, you know, down, you know, as you know, they step out of history, we tend to, you know, look at our leaders more currently, more harshly. But I would like to think that he would have the wisdom to unify us and have us look at ourselves more closely.
You know, Barbara, it's really cool how it just sounds to me like what you've done in writing this book is put your own values and beliefs and vision as a social advocate into your novel. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that is probably a very good way of saying it. Although, you know, I don't want to make it sound that it's preachy in any way. I don't think that it is. I hope that it's not. I've had readers say they didn't feel that. I think it's a natural evolution. Ezra is a big character in this book. He's like the hero. You know, Andy, this 11-year-old, doesn't have any parents, as I said, but Ezra is this young African-American bait shop owner, and he kind of becomes the grounding healing force of the story. And I think what's important about Ezra, like most wonderful mentors do, they teach in parables, like many great prophets, and I think it's not so much he's telling Andy what to think about life, but he's teaching her how to think, how to think in deeper ways, how to make better choices. So, I mean, that, you know, we all have to look deep inside of ourselves, and maybe the choice you make is going to be different than the choice I make. But the important thing is not that we all make the same choice, but that we make the choices that we really have looked at and that we feel are the best course of thing to do, and not just because somebody else has done them or because it's always been that way. So I'm hoping that this book is more about, you know, teaching young people to think, even teaching us older folks to just say, why do I think that way? If I think that way, maybe there's a good reason, and maybe I'll think that through and say, that's why I think that way, and I still think that way. But to look inside ourselves and examine how we feel about, you know, especially, as I said, the things that we fear or, you know, are to examine our hatreds, because they're usually about fears. We really don't hate, we're afraid.
it's interesting to me that we we're going through the book like in crazy detail, but we're going to go a little bit more deeper here because you know it's a really good book. I don't know. Katie, have you? I don't know if you. I don't think Katie got a pre-copy of the book. I have a copy of the book, but I'm not sure Katie did. But Katie, the book is how many pages long is it?
It's really only about 170 pages or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, it's not.
It's a
yeah.
fast read. It's a
it
very
really
fast.
It really is.
Read.
I didn't really put it down, which is a really good sign. I pretty much read it cover to cover. Maybe like less than half a day. So it's a real easy read, but it's a deep read too. And what appears to be just like the story, there's really, really some deep meaning sewn in there or woven in there. And one of them is a real strong there's strong spirituality in there. And I'm wondering why you did that. To some people that might, it might alienate people who don't want that in their book. But why did you do that? And how important is that to the book?
Well, I think it's probably the foundation, and I wanted it. I mean, I think we're all spiritual beings. Even if you're an atheist, I think we're all spiritual. Spiritual doesn't necessarily mean religious, doesn't mean we belong to a formal religion. Just means there's some part of us that's deeper than just, the superficial day-to-day thing we go through. There's some part of us that gives our life a deeper meaning and connection, even if you don't believe there's anything else beyond this life. And I think that's where we find our meaning, is our spirituality. I'm a very spiritual person. It was important to me to write a book that had that component in it. But, and I don't know whether either of you have ever experienced it, but, those transcendent moments that we all have, and I think everybody has, where you just feel like there's this ageless observer that lurks inside of you that, it's ageless, as I said, where you don't feel like you're one age or another, but you just it peeks out every once in a while. Peak moments, I think Maslow called them those peak moments. And I think, we have those. They're rare, but we have those. And that was one connection. As I said, the book starts out where the character is an adult woman who's looking back at her first love. And she feels that ageless observer. She's reading about his death in the newspaper. She's holding the newspaper with the hands of a 50-year-old woman, but she feels like she's 11 years old again all of a sudden in her heart. And it's kind of those moments where we transcend our age. And so that was one thing that happens a few times in the book, and we have to pay attention to those. I wanted to write about that time in life between age 10 to 14, because I think that's a real pivotal time for that soul development. I think things that happen to us during those years are really, really important in shaping who we are. We're not adults, certainly, at that age, but we're not really kids anymore, and we tend to form some really strong lifelong attachments during that age of life, where we're kind of looking at the world through a different sense. So I think, to look at tough social issues and looking at other types of issues through the lens of that age group, we can all kind of identify that, because we're just trying to figure out what we think and feel about life during that time. So that's another reason why I wanted to take that time. But I also think, because the 11-year-old protagonist has lost her parents, if you've encountered death early in your life, you tend to be more aware of what is it? What does it mean to die? Where are they now? Are they any place? And at some point, we all ask those questions. But children who have lost their parents early ask those questions earlier. And, of course, that's all a strong spiritual theme, is what does happen. I think the desire to discover what happens to us after we die becomes a real essential part in finding our meaning here and now. And then again, that's true for for atheists. If they don't believe that there's something afterwards, a lot of them, people who don't believe in a connection in the afterlife, will say, this is where we're going to, you know, this is one shot and we're going to make the most of it. But that's a spiritual process to come to that conclusion. So I think, you know, it was important to me that to look at that and look at the process of death and life. And also because clergy abuse is a theme in this, I wanted to kind of separate that from the spirituality experience, of course.
Well, and I was going to ask you about that because I went to seminary and have been involved with clergy for many, many years, and
okay.
That was a very courageous thing for you to do, to approach that topic. Can you talk a little bit about why?
Well, you know, I think we've got a, you know, again, there's a lot of abuses and social crusades of our time, but I think out of all those types of things, you know, bullying, when I talk about all those types of things, prejudice of all forms, I think that child sex abuse, particularly by clergy, is probably the most horrific crime of all. And, you know, because no one is entrusted with a more sacred or intimate trust than our priests and our holy people. And so the ultimate mentor can, of course, has the potential to become the ultimate betrayer. And they violate, it's a violation of so much more than just bodies at that point, to take your spirituality and mix that up with that type of abuse. That just stuns me. It just stuns me. And I know that there's a lot of attention, but I still am appalled that the outcry and the retribution hasn't been greater. And it's not just the Catholic Church, it's in all forms of, you know, all different religions. But I think there's still a sense of people don't want to hear about it. You know, it was bad enough with Sandusky, you know, the football heroes. People don't want to hear that the people they held in such high regard, that esteem, it's something we kind of tend to not want to hear about. If we don't hear about it, if we don't examine it, if we turn away and keep it in darkness and say, well, that was just that one little thing, it's not, then I don't know that we cure. We get things out at their root and their core. And the 60s was an era when many of these clergy sex crimes were being perpetrated. But it was decades down the road before the scandal in the church was brought to light. And, you know, a lot of times what we hear is that same old phrase, that kids are resilient, kids are resilient. And, you know, the Ezra in this book, when he's trying to, you know, fight on behalf of this young man who was standing up to the priest, he says kids aren't resilient. Kids just know how to stuff their pain way deep down. Then they spend the rest of their lives fighting to keep it from rising to the surface. And I think that's the crux of it. They're not resilient. They do stuff it. And unless we become aware of these things and really look at it, if we don't understand history, you know, we're condemned to repeat it. And I thought, you know, there's not enough attention to this issue, and so I really wanted it to be kind of one of the kingpin issues that's being discussed.
Well, and as a therapist, thank you for saying that, because not all kids are resilient.
That's right.
And that is such a fallacy that I hear all the time.
Yes.
And you know, my husband lost his father when he was 4 years old. Well, he spent a whole lifetime getting, you know, trying to make sense of a life without a dad.
Uh-huh.
And so it's really, really important that, yes, some children are better at being resilient and coping, but there are a whole lot of factors in their life that allow that to happen, but not all kids have those factors.
Exactly.
And I really appreciate you saying that. That's a really important, valuable theme.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, I think, you know, and again, yeah, I think some kids certainly, and it's what we offer them to help them through these traumas. You could have, you know, some of it is our natural psyche, but kids need that support. And in the case of this book, I think, you know, I don't want to talk too much about the endings of the book, but I think, you know, we see the difference when a child gets support versus when they don't, what happens to them.
You have some, I just want to get an eye on time here. Hang on one second. We've got about 20 minutes or so left. And I wanted to ask you about your other books that you...
Oh.
you have two other ones?
Right. I've just finished my second novel. Now, you know, the one of them that I chucked a long time ago, it probably was this novel in a very early format. When I was in college the first time, I wrote my first novel. Up to that, I'd been writing a lot of poetry mostly. But, you know, that novel was always in my brain. And so after searching for Lincoln's Ghost, I went back to that novel and rewrote that one. This one I've titled Losing Is Still Ours, and that's a line from a Rilke poem, which it's a poem called For Hans Carosa, and it was written in 1924. And I chose that title because the idea in that is that loss has meaning also. Maybe we find even the greatest meaning in the things that we lose. And, you know, the most precious thing two individuals can really cherish together is sometimes, you know, the losses that they share, like a parents who've lost a child, or even people who aren't together any longer. Loss doesn't make something lose its meaning. And this is a strong theme of this book. Now, I mentioned already that I'm an ardent admirer of Robert Kennedy. So he's, of course, in this book. This is another 60s book, but this is very much an adult's book. And this is kind of my last 60s foray. My third book is not the 60s theme. But, you know, I really wanted to write a book about two families who are dealing with the changes again that happened in the 60s. This one, the Lincoln book, is 66. The whole book centers around 1966. This book centers around that cataclysmic year of 1968. And, of course, that was the year where Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were murdered. It's a love story. It kind of parallels the idealism and the shatterings of that year, and how two very ordinary families are, how the changes that are happening in the nation are impacting the lives of two families. It's told from different points of view of different narrators, and including a child coming of age, including a soldier who's returning from Vietnam. So it's kind of, you know, again, talking about that period in time. Lance Morrow of Time Magazine described 1968 as kind of a masterpiece of shatterings. And I think that's such a beautiful way of putting it. He says it's a moment that mysteriously stepped outside of time. So this is kind of the theme of that book. And, you know, with this being the 50th year of JFK's assassination, it seems impossible. So much time has gone by. But, you know, and this book is actually a historical fiction, which is another thing that kind of surprises me. But I guess I basically call what I'm writing philosophical fiction, because I think, of course, with my background, I really want a fiction that kind of examines life's meanings and why we do what we do, and kind of, you know, looks at life that way.
And the third book is the third book again is Show Me the Way Home, and how are you doing on that one? You're in the process of writing that one.
That one I've got a what I generally do. I'm pretty much an outline maker, but every book kind of takes a different course, and I wrote it all the way through. But of course, it needs an awful lot of, you know, now I'm going back and doing the editing to make it really say and be what I want it to say and be. This book is going to have a character who's experiencing Alzheimer's disease. And, of course, that's something I know very well from what I've been doing for 15 years, working with families with Alzheimer's. And one of the things that happens with Alzheimer's, it's a stunning disease in the fact that it regresses people backwards. They lose their memories, and they lose their ability to function slowly in reverse order as they learned it. So you see people going back into their past. That's why they don't recognize family members. Because, you know, if you have an 80-year-old husband and you're 80 and he looks, you think he's your father, you're looking for that young husband that you remember, if you even remember being married and having children. And it's a very stunning disease to me in that way, that it kind of erases those layers slowly backwards. And one of the things that we see people say all the time with Alzheimer's, if they reach a certain stage, is even when they are in their own home, they say, I want to go home. Yeah. It's one of the most heartbreaking things for families to deal with.
My grandmother has it. My grandmother is 96.
Okay.
Yeah, and she has Alzheimer's. And in fact, just from when we moved to Maine to now, which we moved here in 2004, she came out here. She was in the garage hanging up, you know, plastic bats for my son's birthday and everything, and then just has slowly declined.
Yeah. So you've seen it firsthand. How many years has she had it now?
What did you say?
How many years has she had it?
It got so bad that she had to be in a nursing home. And there's just no way to, there was absolutely no way to care for her. I don't even know how long she's had it, probably 7 years, 6 years.
Yeah. The average is about 8 to 10, from diagnosis to death. So, yeah, and it does. It's too big of a disease for families to take care of at home. I want to go home. I want to go home is so strong.
Always, yeah. That, and I think the other really, I don't even know the word for what this is, part of this disease, but, you know, like some parts of her brain function perfectly. Like she was a choir singer, in the church choir forever. I mean, forever since a little girl. And so she can still sing perfectly. That might be why. That explains it. When you were saying, they go back to what they remember well, that might explain it because you've been doing something like that forever.
Well, you just hit it right on the head because there's different parts of the brain that are affected, and it just so happens that the right side of the brain is the last part to go if it does go. And what the right side of the brain has is, you know, obviously the longer ago memories that you have, but also the ability to appreciate music is part of the brain that doesn't diminish. So we've heard, you know, we hear stories all the time of people who haven't been able to say a word maybe for 3 years, a spoken word, but they can sing 4 verses of My Country 'Tis of Thee.
That's what we've got going on. It is the most fascinating. And then it's fascinating and horrifying all in one fell swoop because you think, oh, my God, she's back, you know, kind of thing. She's going to know who I am. And then you're like, never mind.
Yeah, well, it corresponds. But, you know, there are some good things that are retained, their ability to feel emotions. And it's great that she retains, you know, because it doesn't make you like music, but if music was important to you in life, then that's a connector that's going to remain and be very powerful and a blessing for the family, really, because it gives you a way to connect with them all the way through if they love music.
Katie, I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second. Katie, are you okay on time?
Yeah, I'm okay. I just have to leave on time. That's all.
Okay, well, I wondered if you would spend a minute and just tell Barbara what you do to connect the dot for her, because I think you guys should probably have a conversation offline and become buddies or something.
Well, when you're talking, Barbara, my background is hospice with children, especially.
Oh my God!
And,
okay. Oh my, what a field! Yeah.
Really, and I went to seminary and studied psychohistory, and so I've got a lot of similar themes. But I'm really and palliative care is what I do now with adults. But one of the things that really strikes me about the way that you write, what you write about, are similar things that I've always loved to read about and write about. Like, I was a big Tolstoy fan.
Oh,
you write
yeah.
a lot about life and death. But I'm wondering, who are your favorite authors?
Oh, I'm very eclectic in who I like as far as my authors. You know, I really like Elizabeth Strauss, who wrote Olive Kittredge. And of course numerous other books, but I think she's got a real poignant depth of understanding of human nature. She won the Pulitzer Prize for that book, I believe. She's a dark writer. A lot of folks feel that it's depressing to read her books. I don't see that, and I think, you know, it's all in your outlook. I think anybody who shines a light on human nature, I mean, it's not depressing, it's just the way it is, and you need to understand those kind of things. So I think that, you know, she has a great way of looking at human nature and why we do the things we do. I like Wally Lamb. I think he's done some great things, The Hour I First Believed, and She's Come Undone, just a couple of them. I ran across a gentleman by the name of Robert Chernow. I don't know that he's written anything other than My Mother, the Cheerleader. But to me, that was a book that kind of resonated with me because it's a book about the 60s, and it's about, it sounds like a funny title. And, people have said if there's one thing they would change about the book, it's the title. And what he's writing about, there was when one of the schools in the South was being segregated, there was a group of white mothers who went and mocked the little African American child who was, I believe, just starting kindergarten or first grade. And there would be a big crowd because she was the only African American who was in the school, and they would go and taunt her. And among them was this group of mothers, and they called them the cheerleaders, and it was documented in the papers back then. And so he writes the book from the perspective of a girl growing up whose mother was one of those cheerleaders, and it's a really, really good book. I like some of Dennis Lehane's. Mystic River was a really good one. I like some of Rosella Brown. But I also like the Russians. I like, my favorite was Ivan Turgenev, who wrote Fathers and Sons. Tolstoy, of course, and, you know, the great Russian writers. And I loved Thomas Hardy growing up. So I'm just kind of very eclectic in who I like and admire.
Have you ever read anything by Dave Eggers?
No, I have not.
I please do me a favor and grab the book, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius.
I'm going to write that down. Say that again to me.
A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius.
Okay.
By Dave Eggers, Eggers.
Okay. I'm going to
like
put that
book,
right up.
The Live Like a Fruit Fly book is good, too. Gabe Berman's book is good.
And I buy my I probably keep Amazon in business all by myself. I mean, I think that this is
all the three of us.
Well, you know, I think it's an easy time to be a writer, but I think it's a hard time to be a successful writer because I don't know that people are buying a lot of books now, and with, you know, the e-books and a lot of the pirating of or reselling e-books or reselling even, you know, hardback and paperback. And of course, you know, I think it's just hard to, you know, or just the use of the library. I think that with the changing, the way things are changing, and so many people are putting books onto the market, I just think it's a great time to be an author, but it's a really bad time to be a successful author. So I pretty much buy anything I want to read.
You know, my kids don't like to read the books because they smell funny. They smell old.
See, that's what I'm afraid of.
That's
yeah.
just the most interesting comment. I'm like, really? That's why? And he's like, no. And he brought one home. He's like, smell this. It smells funny and old. And why don't they reprint this and put a new one in here or something? They're old and yucky. And so he's a big. I have four boys, and the two younger ones just really don't like to check out books. And they're both pretty adamant on they just don't smell good. They smell old or mildewy or yucky, you know, kind of thing. So they're always on the iPad downloading books. So they'll read, but on the iPad. or on the
That's
phone.
That's true, though. When I was a child, and when you say that, I can remember, you know, they say the smells is the quickest way into their heart and our memories, you know.
Uh-huh.
And when you said that, I can remember feeling that way, too, as a child. I guess some of the library books had that smell about them. And, you know, the,
I guess now
yeah.
there's an alternative, though.
You know, I read Kindle, but it's not the same, you know.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Nope.
I mean, I guess it's what you grow up with. Yeah.
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 And,
I've got a garage full of my grandmother's books.
Yeah, I have so many books. And
I can't let go of them.
If you go under the age of, I don't even know what the age might be, maybe 25, for sure, right now, the 10, 12, 14-year-old crowd, they are not really big book readers.
Uh-huh.
They're iPad readers, e-book readers kind of thing, but very difficult to get that crowd into a library.
Well, you know, and I also think with, you know, with television and with computers and iPads and computer games and, you know, there's so much competing for our entertainment attention. Back in the day, we didn't have all these things and people read more. And I hope, you know, serious readers don't, you know, that's not a dying breed. I hope not.
Yeah, I kind of let them be fairly peaceful on the TV. Because I know they don't watch a lot of junk. They're usually glued to, like, the History Channel or the Discovery Channel or something at least informative on TV. So
yeah.
that's not so bad. So I know there's information going in their brains other than Xbox.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Good.
Yeah. It's a changing time. It's really a very odd time for the publishing industry. I think it's really changing so radically, and it'll be interesting how it all falls out. You know.
Katie, did you want to add anything there on the books?
Well, you know, it is such a difference because, like I said, I can't let go of my books. I need to build a house just for a whole room full of books. But my daughter is all Kindle. She's all Kindle, except
mm-hmm.
I will say she loves the library.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know
That's
why,
great.
But she just loves to have a book in her hand. So I think it's just... any kid is different, and but it is definitely a changing time, and people are building smaller houses. They don't want to carry around their books anymore. They want convenience. Everything needs to be. I mean, if you look at any culture in any time in history, there's always different themes, and in our culture now, convenience is a big one.
Absolutely, you know, and it's just different. It's probably not a bad thing. I think the key when you said is she likes to read. I mean, if you instill
yeah.
that in your kids, that's there you go. Doesn't matter if they read a Kindle or they read a hard book. As long as they, you know, they enjoy that process, I think that's the important thing, you know.
Yeah, mine like
yeah.
magazines. They're big into the magazines, especially sports magazines and stuff like that. And they do like to go to the actual bookstore and buy the book new. So that could
uh-huh.
be maybe a spoiled factor. I don't know. Let's go to the library. That's funny. Barbara, did we miss anything in just getting to know you and talking about, I can think of one thing, and that would be your website, because you've got a website out there for your books. And
yeah.
But as I'm giving this information out, just if you think of something else, please let me know. But
well,
Barbara's
yeah.
website is B-A-R-B-A-R-A-J. Everybody get a pen. Ready? BZIKOWSKI.com. Or what I did is I searching for Lincoln's ghost and then clicked on your website.
That's the easiest way.
I didn't want to get the spelling wrong.
Yeah. I wish I could, you know, name the website something different, but with other books coming out, I wanted to do the author. And unfortunately, that's the name, you know.
I've got the same deal going on. My website's so long, ElizabethHamiltonGarino.com. It's forever. So, but I registered eGarino, but I don't think that's going to do much for me. I think you got to just keep your name. It's all good.
Well, I'm interested, though, in the hospice work. I mean, I want to just commend you for that. I think, you know, I think it takes a really special person to do hospice. And, you know, we work a lot with the hospice here. Where we serve our families, and it's amazing work. It's heartrending work, but I know it's also very spiritually enriching work. So I really commend you for serving in that area. I think it's a fascinating and wonderful and very difficult area.
You know, it's funny. People say that a lot, and I just feel like I learn and get so many gifts from doing it. Just amazing. I really, because like you're writing, life and death and meaning in life, I get that every day.
Mm-hmm.
I have
Absolutely.
Rich conversations every single day. So I do, and Elizabeth is definitely going to agree with me on this. I do have bad hair days, but I really don't because when you're faced with life and death every day, a bad hair day doesn't mean anything.
That's generally the way you are. You're like, well, you know, I don't feel so good today, but, you know, this person really doesn't feel good today, so I'm going to put myself in
there.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
and I bet
you have
a
nice way of doing that.
I bet some of the stories, too, that you hear from dying patients is pretty incredible work, so it's great.
Especially kids. Uh-huh. Kids. I mean, like little Austin, who 3 days before he died tells his mom that the purpose of life is to make a difference, and when she says, well, how do you know that, and I don't, he said, well, you did, Mom, but you grew up.
Oh, man, that's pretty profound.
Yeah, so I get stuff like that all the time from people who are facing life and death, and so it is really a blessing, and I can't wait to read your novels because you sound like a novella of Tolstoy.
Yeah, that's a good book. And,
well, you know,
yeah.
When you just said that, I mean, there is the line in the book, they quote Dickens, that, you know, we're closer to the angels when we're young, so pay attention to the things that move you, and that just, when you said that, it just reminds me of that.
Yep. Oh, that's very a great cool. quote. I would love that quote. Elizabeth, I can't write that down for me, will you?
I will. It's in her book. All right. Okay. Well, wonderful speaking with you. What a joy, and thank you for being here with us for the full hour. I know it's we ask a lot of people when we ask them to spend an hour talking about themselves, but you did brilliantly.
Well, thank you so much. You made it comfortable and easy. Thank you very much.
And, okay, so I just want to tell everybody the name of the book one more time. It's Searching for Lincoln's Ghost, and it'll probably be a movie, so this will probably be a recording to treasure. And when you're famous and on your movie set, you make sure and remember us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you
for the great work you do, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Sherry Rosen, thank you. Shout out to Sherry for connecting us. I appreciate you always. And lots of love. Have a beautiful day. And Katie, have a wonderful day.
Yep.
Barbara, have a wonderful
you
day.
You too.
And,
enjoy today.
Yep. And our next show, Katie, Tuesday, May 14th with Pam Hale. We look forward to having Pam on as a guest, too. All right, take care, everyone. Bye,
All
Barbara.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Best Ever You Show. Want more? Visit us at besteveryou.com. Be your best and keep it real. Confident, successful, caring, and beautiful every day with Best Ever You.